Good evening, Truth Seekers. Welcome to tonight's program. My name is Mike Malloy at 7 past the hour. A lot of interesting things happening today. I told you it wouldn't take long for Karen Handel to resign, which she did today. Skank. And we have a new moment with Bob that I'll be sharing with you maybe this hour. And just as a preview of this, if you have had or know someone with an addiction problem, you want to listen to tonight's moment with Bob. This hour is sponsored by James Herlihy. He says, I'm sponsoring a show to celebrate my birthday. However, you don't need an excuse to be a sponsor or a podcast subscriber. Support Mike, Kathy, and Molly. Well, thank you, James. That's very kind. Happy birthday, James. I would sing it for you, but we'll send you cookies instead. He gets cookies? Okay, he gets cookies. Yes, he does. James, thank you very much for the sponsorship. We appreciate it. When I'm researching and finding stuff to talk about, which isn't very hard during the day, I'll sometimes put little notes in the margin. And the only note I have on this piece is filthy, filthy bastard banks. Ooh, filthy, filthy bastard banks. What this is about, J.P. Morgan Chase. Right now, this is February. We all know what happens on February. Oh, that's Black Awareness Month. Yeah, every February. The other 11 months, it's all right. But in February, Black Awareness Month. Yee-haw. J.P. Morgan Chase has a campaign right now, an ad campaign, a PR campaign, that talks about helping that bank, helping to fulfill the vision of Martin Luther King Jr. Oh, praise Jesus, J.P. Morgan Chase. Oh, aren't they wonderful? They're helping to fulfill the vision of Martin Luther King Jr., which is a bunch of crap. The vision of Martin Luther King Jr., right before they murdered him, was to take a place like J.P. Morgan Chase and disappear it. But never mind. Never mind. That's real history. We are involved in revisionist history. J.P. Morgan Chase, while they are running this campaign, has now come under fire for threatening to evict an almost 80-year-old woman named Helen Bailey in Nashville, Tennessee. She is a former civil rights activist, just like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Helen Bailey, Nashville, Tennessee. Former civil rights activist, and J.P. Morgan Chase wants to throw her out on the street because she can't keep up with her mortgage payments. There's a petition, by the way, to save her house. It's at change.org. Change.org. Ms. Bailey attempted to refinance with the company that would have let her stay in the home until she died. Sounds like a reverse mortgage. But she says she couldn't convince J.P. Morgan Chase to reduce her principal by $9,000. That's all they had to do. Reduce it by $9,000. You filthy, filthy bastard bank. Other civil rights activists have already joined the more than 35,000 people who have signed on to the petition asking the bank, would you please accept an offer to purchase Ms. Bailey's home from an alternate buyer? Now, the uproar comes because the bank is featuring a page on its website talking about its commitment to, quote, do our part to uphold Dr. King's vision. What would that be, J.P. Morgan Chase? What was Dr. King's vision? What, the Negroes could eat at a lunch counter with the Caucasians? Is that the vision? Riding in the front of the bus with the Caucasians? Was that the vision? Or was Dr. King's vision one of taking predatory capitalism which J.P. Morgan Chase represents beautifully, by the throat and strangling the goddamn thing until it was completely dead. That was the vision of Dr. King. But we don't talk about that. We talk about, oh, let's all be happy here in America. The Caucasians and the Negroes, and we might even let a few, you know, Mexicans in too, and we'll all, not the queers, and we'll all be happy. Except, you know, on Sunday morning, the most segregated hour in America, you go to your church, Dr. King, we'll go to ours. Just don't forget, Jesus is white. Miss Bailey's home state is not at the center of the foreclosure crisis. Only one out of every 885 Tennessee housing units received a foreclosure filing in December, according to Huffington Post. And they get their number from Realty Track. Princeton professor and civil rights activist Cornel West, you're familiar with his name, right? Every right-wing son of a bitch in America tries to demonize Cornel West, but he said in a press release that, quote, I strongly support my dear sister Helen Bailey. Her struggle for justice is legendary. I stand with her, end quote. In addition to Cornel West, other black community leaders as well as the Occupy Nashville protesters have taken up Bailey's cause. If efforts prove unsuccessful, Miss Bailey will be forced to leave her home the day after Valentine's Day. That's right, February 15th. Aw, what a Valentine present from J.P. Morgan Chase. Oh, you hypocritical sons of bitches. You really are. Hypocrisy is kind of the theme tonight. Third hour is going to be a barn burner, but J.P. Morgan Chase, ooh, we want to keep the dream alive. You know, in order to dream, you have to be asleep, right? J.P. Morgan, it says here, isn't the first bank to draw unwanted attention because of a controversial foreclosure. Bank of America threatened foreclosure in November over a missing $1 payment on a home that was already sold. In October, an elderly couple was faced with the possibility of foreclosure after making a payment too early and using an incorrect routing number on a different payment. By the way, altogether, 2.6 million foreclosure filings were handed to 1.8 million housing units last year, according to Realty Track. So the horrific numbers continue. The Republicans are going to do nothing and nothing. Barack Obama can propose and propose and propose. And even what he proposes is tissue paper thin and getting soaked. But the Republicans won't even go for that. So we now have a Nashville, Tennessee-based former civil rights activist named Helen Bailey, who's almost 80. She cannot keep up with her mortgage payments. Isn't this a great country? A woman, 80 years old, still has mortgage payments, huh? I'll bet that's because she bought a house way too big, right? It was that damn Acorn. They're the ones that did it to her, right? Oh, yeah, we know, we know. Well, like I said at the top of this, filthy, filthy bastard banks. Every single one of them. Read and write. A child is black.
The Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
There's an article that's up at alternate.org, and the title of it is, I Will Not Be Pinkwashed. Komen's race is for money, not cure. And I strongly recommend it. It's written by Emily Michelle. She writes about natural health and real nutrition at her website, butherbeliever.com. But if you want to read a different point of view about the Susan G. Komen Foundation and what it's really about, check it out. Meantime, the crazy woman who went into the Komen Foundation with the express purpose of giving them an excuse to break their ties with Planned Parenthood, which she did with the permission, apparently, of the Komen board. And then the backlash was so horrible that the Komen Foundation realized, we're going to lose all of our money. We won't be able to pay our CEO $500,000 a year. OMFG, get rid of her. So, of course, Karen Handel resigned. I thought it would take a week or so, but it only took a few days. Handel said in her letter of resignation, I am deeply disappointed by the gross mischaracterizations of the strategy, its rationale, and my involvement in it. I openly acknowledge my role in the matter and continue to believe our decision was the best one for Komen's future and the women we serve. Handel said in the letter also that the now abandoned policy of shredding its relationship with Planned Parenthood was fully vetted by the Komen organization. Karen Handel says the board did not raise any objections when it was presented back in November. Komen founder and CEO Nancy Brinker said she accepted Handel's resignation and wished her well. Earlier today, when this was made official, Planned Parenthood did not respond to messages from the AP seeking comment. Now, until today, Karen Handel, and like I said, we know her here in Georgia. She was on, what was it, Fulton County Commission, and then she was Secretary of State, and for a year, I think. I don't know how she got that appointment. And then she ran for governor against the dumbass that we now have. What's his name? Nathan Deal, I always forget his name. He's just so goddamn stupid. It's like a broom sitting over in the corner over our... It's hard for me to remember. What's his name? Say again. Nathan Deal. I keep thinking Nathan Hale.
It's like a used car salesman.
That's what he
sounds like one,
he does.
Looks like one.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. But anyway, the way he beat...
Let's make a deal!
The way he beat Karen Handel, he just outright winged her. She didn't expect it. Everybody knew Karen Handel was like I don't know, just one goose step short of being a Nazi. But somehow, Nathan Deal out goose stepped her and became governor. I mean, this state produces some really vile vomit that goes up on the national stage. Newt Gingrich, of course, I don't even attempt to go there. Anyway, up until today, Ms. Handel publicly kept silent about her role in the dispute. In her letter, she said the controversy surrounding Planned Parenthood was long a concern of Komen officials. What controversy? There is no controversy. Handel said in her letter, neither the decision nor the challenges themselves were based on anyone's political beliefs or ideology. And the moon is made out of little blue spiders, and they all hang together up there, especially tonight when it's full, and you think it's a moon. It's not. It's trillions of blue spiders. And the decision to break with Planned Parenthood was not based on anyone's political beliefs or ideology. We just woke up one morning and said, well, I know. Let's break off our relationship with Planned Parenthood. And have you seen that full moon? It's made up of spiders.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. So Karen Handel claims that the board of Susan Komen and she, Karen Handel, were all on the same page that the specific reason to hire Karen Handel was to be the political coordinator who would work with flying monkey right members of Congress, in this case Cliff Stearns of Florida, to put together a phony, you know, investigation of Planned Parenthood so that the amended bylaws of the company... It is a company, the Komen Foundation. They are in it for the money. That the new bylaws written, section written about, well, we're not going to make grants to any company or any organization under investigation. It all worked very nicely, and Karen Handel was hired specifically to do that. Now, a person, according to the Associated Press, a person with direct knowledge of decision-making at Komen's headquarters in Dallas, Texas, said the grant-making criteria were adopted with the deliberate intention of targeting Planned Parenthood. The criteria's impact on Planned Parenthood and its status as the focus of government investigations were highlighted in a memo distributed to Komen affiliates in December. Now, according to this person who spoke obviously on conditions of anonymity for fear of her goddamn life, probably. I mean, you don't mess with something as big as the Komen Foundation and not wind up with concrete shoes on your feet walking around the bottom of Houston Ship Channel, booby. But according to this person, a driving force behind the move was Karen Handel, who was hired specifically because of her views and the fact that when she ran for governor, she frequently denounced Planned Parenthood. I denounce you. I denounce you. So hire her, right? Now, the odd part of this. Well, first of all, Brinker, in an interview with MSNBC last week, said Karen Handel didn't have a significant role in the policy change. This is the thing. It's never the crime. It's the cover-up, right? That goes back to Watergate. Huh? It's not the crime. It's your filthy lies. It's your dirty, stinking cover-up, Ms. Brinker. Of course, Nancy Brinker has been schooled by experts like Turd Blossom, for one. And all sorts of right-wing anti-women operatives who see the Susan Komen Foundation as a way to make a lot of money. Oh, man. A lot of money. There's a lot of money in the cancer business. Just like there's a lot of money in the God business. You know what I'm saying? Oh, yeah. Anyway, the way Handel was defeated here in Georgia was by Nathan Deal turning her, trying to turn her into a liberal. I mean, you should see the contortions here in Georgia by some of these rat bastards. You really should. Deal, Nathan Deal, the guy who is now our governor, the one who looks, acts, and talk like a very slow-thinking used car lot salesman. One of those used car lots out on the edge of town, you know, we finance here. They're all over the South. We finance here. Deal repeatedly attacked Karen Handel over a 2005 vote that she took while serving on the Fulton County Commission, which is mostly Atlanta. And the vote was to give more than $400,000 to Planned Parenthood. Though not for abortion services, you know, but the Georgia affiliate of Planned Parenthood said the money went to a downtown clinic for services such as cervical cancer screening, testing for sexually transmitted diseases, and birth controls. Birth control, yeah. So Nathan Deal, the drooling, gibbering Caucasian that now is the governor of Georgia, used that to demonize Karen Handel, and she certainly deserved it because she's one of these right-wing Christian freaks. But it's kind of like, it reminds me of the George Wallace campaign. The initial campaign, George Wallace, when he ran for governor, he was kind of a moderate. He really was. He was a Democrat. He started out as a Democrat, George Wallace, over in Alabama, kind of a moderate. Didn't have any problem with black folk. Had black folk on his staff, yada, 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 and he lost. I think he lost. Didn't he lose to Big Jim Folsom, I think? I don't know. But anyway, after his defeat, that first time, George Wallace famously said, and I can't use the word, but he famously said, I'm never going to let any of those suckers out N-word me again. And from that point on, he became an absolute. Now, he repented before he died, all shot up by Arthur Bremer, who put bullets all up and down his spine or whatever. At some point, when he could no longer control his bowels or his bladder, and he realized that his true friends were the people from way back in the day. I don't know why I'm going on and on about this. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that Karen Handel decided, after Nathan Deal handed her her own ass in the governor's race here, she decided, well, they'll never out Planned Parenthood me again. Same thing. With George Wallace, it was, to use a term popular back then, the Negroes. And Wallace made it very clear, they'll never out-N-word me again. And he became a screaming, frothing, foaming-at-the-mouth racist. His famous stand in the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama. You will not enter here, you colored people! Well, Karen Handel decided after the Planned Parenthood issue defeated her bid for governor. Of course, she never had a chance to be governor. Here in Georgia, we don't elect white ladies to be governor. We just don't do that. White ladies are supposed to run a church, maybe, or something like that. But we don't elect white ladies as governor. No, we don't do that. They can be Sunday school superintendent, but they ain't going to be governor. And Karen, of course, didn't understand that. I mean, I don't know what she was thinking. I guess she was thinking, well, I was a county commissioner and I was secretary of state for a year, so I can be governor. No, no, you can't. But what you can do is go over to the Susan G. Komen Foundation and disrupt something that's been going on for 25 years, but it's a good thing, too, because now the scrutiny on the Susan Komen Foundation is going to be like a hot, bright light of a thousand suns. And maybe what people will find out, I don't know, but maybe what people will find out will incline a lot of folks to say, oh, wait a minute, what? Really? We'll see, won't we? As you know, a federal appeals court today declared California's same-sex marriage ban unconstitutional. It took an appeals court to do that, of course. But the court agreed to give the haters and the homophobes time to appeal the ruling before ordering the state to resume allowing gay couples to wed. Now, can you imagine a right-wing decision like that? Okay, we're going to ban same-sex marriage, but before we put it into effect, we'll give all you queers a chance to run down to the courthouse and get married. And, you know, because some of you queers may want to appeal what we've decided here today. Can you imagine that happening? No, you can't. And do you know why? Because right-wingers are lying, hypocritical bastards. Republicans, conservatives, right-wingers, down to the last man or woman. Do you think they would play like that? The way this court has, okay, it's unconstitutional because the law was designed specifically to deny people equal protection under the law. And guess what? You can't do that. Yeah, the court said Prop 8 serves no purpose and has no effect other than to lessen the status and human dignity of gays and lesbians in California and to officially reclassify their relationships and families as inferior to those of opposite sex couples. End quote. And, you know, still, I mean, it's all that is disappearing rather rapidly here in the late, great United States of America. But at one time, it didn't take a court to rule that people had. Oh, what am I saying? It's always taken a court to rule that.
Love and marriage, love and marriage. They go together like a horse and carriage. This I'll tell you, brother. You can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage. It's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry, and they will say it's
soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Another thing that usually freaks me out is how right-wing black folk can get very, very righteously upset about their history in this country. And I'm not talking about the slavery. I'm talking about the Jim Crow laws and the absolute refusal of the Caucasians to acknowledge black folk as human. Until it took laws, it took several Supreme Court rulings, it took legislation signed by Lyndon Johnson and on and on and on to finally make the point of, look, we're in this together, black, brown, white, just like the old song you used to sing in Sunday school, red and yellow, black and white, God will keep them in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. Remember that? Former RNC Chairman Michael Steele was on MSNBC's one of the programs this morning, and he used Ron Paul's so-called states' rights defense. It's not Ron Paul's. States' rights was a defense put together to allow lynching, to allow slavery, to allow just damn near everything. But anyway, Michael Steele is saying, well, states' rights should prevail where it concerns Prop 8 in California. States should decide who should be allowed to marry. Now, the argument is stupid, grossly stupid on its face. We've already ruled many, many times there are not two classes of citizenship in this country unless you've been convicted of a felony. But if you are just an American, you don't have rights that someone else has. Conversely, you don't have fewer rights than someone else has. It's so simple. But to Michael Steele, it doesn't make any difference. This is a case where it really makes no difference what this man's skin color is. He's still a goddamn bigot. So, he tries to use the old states' rights argument. But when he was asked by one of the people on the panel how he would feel if a state passed a law saying he couldn't marry a white woman, Michael Steele, according to Crooks and Liars, went into an incoherent and belligerent rant about his skin color, making bigotry against gays different from racism against blacks. And he used the typical conservative tactic of feigned outrage at even being asked the question. I can't understand. You know, as Crooks and Liars, John Amato writing here, he said, Republicans never have to make sense on television. That's another reason why propping up a states' rights neo-Confederate who has libertarian views is a dangerous thing to do on the left. And now Republicans like Steele are emboldened to pick and choose a states' rights argument to justify discrimination? And let's not forget, the states' rights argument was made out of the Southern strategy of racial politics when the black movement was on the rise in this country during Reagan's days. Michael Steele, who I sometimes find entertaining, like so many of these talking heads on television, there's few that I find very entertaining. I never liked Michael Steele when he was an apologist for this rapacious, murderous Republican Party. But once he was replaced because the caucasoids couldn't take him anymore, he became, you know, kind of entertaining. He really did. Sure, wound up on Rachel Maddow's program, goes on Morning Joe, goes here, goes there. Hey, how you doing, Michael? Pretty soon. I think he is now fonted as a MSNBC consultant. But God forbid you should point out to Michael Steele the similarities in saying to a gay couple, you may not make a contract, and saying to a black man, you may not vote. Oh, wait a minute. I was born with black skin. I see. And you're suggesting that the gay man was not born that way. Do you know what, Michael? It doesn't make any goddamn difference. It doesn't matter if somebody is born gay or becomes gay through, I don't know, little woodland fairies jumping into their room at night, sprinkling fairy dust on them, or if they choose to be gay. It's none of your business, Michael, but you may not make laws against them. In the same manner that making laws against African Americans was poisonous, rotten, and illegal. Unconstitutional. So, in the meantime, where is that? Over in, did I mention this hour is being sponsored by James Herlihy? James almost let this hour get passed. He says, I'm sponsoring a show to celebrate my birthday. Happy birthday, James. However, you don't need an excuse to be a sponsor or a podcast subscriber. Support Mike, Kathy, and Molly. Thank you, James. Happy birthday to... No, don't do that. Thank you, James. I appreciate it very much. In the meantime, while the appeals court in California is declaring Prop 8 to be unconstitutional, in Uganda, a member of parliament has reintroduced a bill there that increases criminal penalties for homosexual acts. He dropped the provision that allows homosexuals to be executed by the state. But I want you to hear this. Now, why Uganda? Why a country in Central Africa? Because it was Caucasian fundamentalist right-wing Christian preachers who went to Uganda and convinced the darkies to write a law that said gay people will be executed. And that's how they look at the Ugandans, as darkies. Sponsored by Gray and Lauren. And Gray and Lauren have a message. Here it is. U.S. post offices built before the war, that would be WW2, are the handsomest buildings in many small towns across America, and often have the only public art in those towns. In major cities, post offices are palaces of the people, and they provide universal service at a reasonable price. But the U.S. Postal Service plans to close half of them before it liquidates itself. To find out why, please go to SaveThePostOffice.com. And thank you for keeping us lit, Mike and Kathy. Signed, Gray and Lauren. Thanks, folks. I appreciate that very much. Excuse me. SaveThePostOffice.com. Visit the website. Take a look. Now, regarding Prop 8 being declared unconstitutional, the court recognizes that marriage is not... something that comes from the church. It comes from the state. I've said it before. I don't care what religion the holy person who performs the ceremony is. At some point, he or she says the following: "And now, by the power vested in me by the state of California, New York, Arizona, I now pronounce you man and wife." At that moment, the religious person is acknowledging something very clearly and very specifically, that it is not the church or the temple or the synagogue or the mosque that makes a marriage a marriage. It is the state. Now, if somebody wants to have their marriage sanctified, so to speak, by some religious craziness, go ahead. Have at it. But your marriage is not a marriage unless it is recognized by the state. Now, to try to jump around this stuff is a right-wing tactic. It's you know, arguing a point that completely obscures what they're really about. The right-wingers just hate the fact that gay folk can make a contract. That's all. Why? You can't do that. You're gay. So what? So what? So, it says in Leviticus your ass is doomed. Well, it also says in Leviticus that if my child talks snotty to me, I should take my son out in the backyard and kill him.
I've thought about it.
Oh, Jesus, God, I get so sick of these religious freaks. All right, so while California says this is unconstitutional, a Ugandan member of parliament has introduced a bill in that country that increases criminal penalties for homosexual acts. His new bill drops a provision that heretofore allowed homosexuals to be executed by the state. Woo! You remember that. The parliamentarian, his name is David Bahati, today reintroduced the so-called Kill the Gays bill that he had first introduced in 2009. It was later shelved in 2011 after an international outcry. Homosexuality is already illegal in Uganda, but under the original bill, some homosexual acts would have been punished by death. The latest iteration of the bill increases current punishment for certain acts to life in prison. Ugandans now also face criminal prosecution if they fail to report homosexuals to authorities. In 2010, President Obama called the first version of the bill odious. I wonder what he's going to call this one. Now, Uganda? What the hell is going on here? Well, from March 5th to March 8th, 2009, a workshop took place in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, that featured three American evangelical right-wing Christians. Scott Lively, an author who has written several books opposing homosexuality. See, Scott Lively thinks that God made a mistake. Of course, Scott Lively is going to have his head pinched off when he goes to heaven and have it cast into hell for the demons to play soccer with. But I digress. Caleb Lee Brundage was the second man, a self-professed former gay man who conducts sessions to heal homosexuality. And a guy named Don Schmeirer, a board member of Exodus International, an organization devoted to promoting freedom from homosexuality through the power, amen, of Jesus the Christ. Now, the theme of the conference, according to the New York Times, was the gay agenda. You know what the gay agenda is, don't you? They'll come into your house or apartment and redecorate it. The theme of the conference was the gay agenda, how to make gay people straight, how gay men sodomized children, and how the gay movement is an evil institution whose goal is to defeat the marriage-based society and replace it with a culture of sexual promiscuity. Now, that's what these three Caucasian, right-wing, American, evangelical, Jesus-murdering preachers went to Uganda to talk about. And they convinced people in Uganda that homosexuality was just like child molestation and bestiality. Well, that's what Rick Santorum believes, too. And it causes high rates of divorce. Scott Lively, one of the Caucasoids who went there, his emphasis was on the African family. And he said that the African family was being threatened by homosexuals looking to recruit youth into their ranks. So at the end of this conference, after these very important Caucasoids had come all the way from the United States to inform the Ugandans that the queers are coming. The queers are coming. The queers are coming. And they're going to take your children. No, those are Catholic priests that are going to take your children. The queers are coming. Quick, we have to do something. I know. Let's have the death penalty. Woo-hoo! The death penalty for who you fall in love with. Now, what's the difference between Rick Santorum and these three preachers who went to Uganda with the express purpose of leaving behind something as vile and filthy and full of hate and disgust as a parliament that would prescribe death for people who happen to be gay? What's the difference between Rick Santorum and those three evangelical Christians? Nothing. That's what's the difference. Don't kid yourself for a second. Somebody like Rick Santorum, who takes the typical right-wing horse hockey and says, oh, well, you know, hate the sin, but love the sinner. That's nonsense. What is going on here is religion is attacking every single civil institution in this country while at the same time declaring that they are under attack. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. I'm being attacked! While you're chopping someone up with a machete. I'm being attacked! He keeps hitting the blade of my machete with his face! I'm being attacked! We'll be right back.
On Goat, a government-owned alien territory in space, a birth of magnificent and magical proportions took place. But the birth was not finite, it was infinite. As the wombs numbered and the mitosis of the future began, it was perceived that this infamous moment in life is not temporary.
When he
break. A moment with Bob. Rick Santorum wins Minnesota and Missouri. Oh my God! Republicans in Minnesota. Okay. I love it. Just keep it going. Keep it going. You go, Mitt. You know, I don't understand, excuse me, why the Catholic crazy people, the Catholic Church primarily, Catholics are not independent thinkers. Catholic women will use birth control whenever they damn well please now, but Catholics for the most part are not independent thinkers. They've had that part of themselves scrubbed. Whenever they do try to be an independent thinker, they have been told for years and years and years that these are sins. That if you think for yourself and yourself says, you know, I don't want to get pregnant again, I think I'll use birth control, you are committing, in that case, a mortal sin. That's a bad one. There used to be a place to be scrubbed even after you were dead, purgatory. I think purgatorio, I think that has been eliminated now. I don't know, maybe it hasn't. And as a kid, I can remember going with my Catholic friends into church on Wednesdays when they had confession and watching them light candles and offer up prayers to get people out of purgatory. And, you know, I would say to my little Catholic buddies, First of all, they had to define it for me, what purgatory. Well, it's not like hell, but it's almost as bad. Well, what happens there? Well, you just feel very uncomfortable, and you feel bad and terrible, and you got to pray, and if you're alive, you pray to get people out of purgatory, people that weren't baptized, or people that died without extreme unction, or hadn't had their last confession, or whatever. And I said, well, how long does it take to get out of purgatory? Oh, God, it can take, 50,000 years. What? 50? Well, I mean, oh, well, time is different in purgatory. Oh, so if I'm alive for 5 more years and pray every day, will that get a person out of purgatory? Maybe. I mean, it's just maddening stuff. Insane stuff. So my question, why doesn't the Catholic Church drop the nonsense about birth control? Because the latest stat I read is 80% of Catholic women do birth control if they feel like it. So why not drop it and focus on what the Catholic Church does best? Cover up for priests who sexually violate children. Scare the daylights out of people who think the church has the power to send them all to eternal pain and suffering. That's what you people do. Why don't you get your religious nutsiness out of somebody's sex life? It's none of your goddamn business. Who was it that said about one of the popes, if he no play of the game, he no make of the rules? I mean, if the Catholic Church and the hierarchy and the Pope, I mean, if they're really concerned about the human race, well, then for goodness sake, focus on something that makes sense. Like helping people get educated. Of course, when they do, then the first thing they kick is the Catholic Church. Helping people get educated. Helping people overcome poverty. Helping people live without fear, ending war, ending nuclear weapons. There are so many priests and nuns who actually do that. And they go to jail for it. And what does the Catholic hierarchy say? Oh, do we have some more priests and nuns go to jail? Okay. And listening to all these Republican thug candidates, Romney and Gingrich and this puke Santorum running around the country trying to, I'm the one, screaming about the stipulation covering birth control in insurance. Oh no, birth control. Birth control. Oh my God. It's in the insurance policies. Oh, my God. Another example of just, I mean, monumental hypocrisy. Lies, deceit. The whole thing is about this ongoing right-wing Christian campaign to reduce women down to the level of property. Do what I tell you. No birth control for you. And if I have my way, no voting for you. And what's wrong with me belting you a couple of times if you really need it? What are you going to do, run to a cop? Shut up. It drives me crazy. Crazy. Moment with Bob when we come back. 25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Gray and Lauren. Lauren writes, U.S. post offices built before the war are the handsomest buildings in many small towns across America and often have the only public art in those towns. In major cities, post offices are palaces of the people, and they provide universal service at a reasonable price. But the U.S. Postal Service plans to close half of them before it liquidates itself. To find out why, please visit SaveThePostOffice.com. And thank you for keeping us lit, Mike and Kathy. Signed, Gray and Lauren. Thanks. Thanks, Gray. Thanks, Lauren. I appreciate it very much. I have in front of me here another moment with Bob, and there's something here that says the return of Mike Malloy Radio Gumshoe is in the offing. Oh, my God. Another moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight's title, Up a Lazy River. Hey, Mike. I went to a treatment center for alcoholism 22 years ago. How's that for creating a 100% guaranteed awkward pause? I know, I know. It's one of the most repellent conversation openers, topped only by, have you accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior? Or better yet, sometimes you get the double whammy from some guy who found God at a treatment center, turned his life around, and is now spreading the good news as a clean and sober Christian. Hallelujah! If anybody starts talking to me about how they successfully kick drugs or alcohol, I try to make some positive noises while looking around for the exit. Of course, I'm happy they solved their problem. I just don't want to hear about it. It's not that I lack empathy. I mean, I certainly can relate to everything people have to deal with when lives simultaneously explode and implode because of alcoholism. But the details aren't all that interesting. It's like being cornered by a doddering relative at a family gathering and having to listen for the umpteenth time about how my second cousin, whom I've never met, had a heck of a time changing a flat tire during a snowstorm in 1957. Or was it 59? That said, I will now plow ahead into what happened at the treatment center. But don't worry, I didn't find Jesus, and I'm definitely not any friend of Bill. I didn't find a higher power, and I leave it to others who've got the stamina to enter that wild goose chase. What I did learn was that a small dietary change consisting of no sugar, no caffeine, no refined carbs, along with a couple of vitamin and mineral supplements, completely stops the craving for alcohol after about a week. I found it was pretty easy to stop doing something once I didn't want it anymore. So here I am, 22 years later, because I still don't have any physiological cravings for alcohol. It has nothing to do with strength of character, willpower, or the hand of God. I don't want any lima beans either, but nobody gets a chip after 22 years of successfully abstaining from that wretched legume. But getting back to the treatment center, I met a strange crew of inmates sitting around in pajamas at the home. People yak all the time how alcoholism cuts through all social strata, but the high rollers went somewhere else to dry out. My group tended to have less teeth and more tattoos. I also found it, if you're really, really bored, it is possible to smoke 5 or 6 packs of cigarettes a day. The counselors had all risen from the ranks of users and had become clean and sober automatons. I knew that because their daily lectures were punctuated with mini-bios of how they overcame their own struggles with demon rum. One counselor in particular impressed me with her sing-songy story told like a bored third-rate carnival hypnotist running through his patter for the 10,000th time. She always ended her case history by proclaiming that she was now happy, joyous, and free, as if it were some kind of curse. I did my 28 days and went back out into the real world, armed with a new dietary regimen and renewed hope for the future. Later, I ended up working at the home. The only real difference between wearing pajamas or a tie and a name tag was that I got a paycheck, and at the end of the shift, I could leave the grounds without making the security guards nervous. I don't mean to diminish my time spent at the home, either as a patient or a trustee. Eliminating the physiological craving for alcohol has been a huge boon for my brain function, self-esteem, and hygiene. In spite of all my lost years due to living under the influence, I actually learned something from the storm and drang of addiction. Denial is one tough son of a bitch. Depending on what study you read, about 8 to 10% of the population is addicted to alcohol. In most cases, the addict is the last one to admit that, Houston, we have a problem. Almost everything can be lost. And most of the time, the alcoholic still won't acknowledge his alcoholism. That's how tenacious denial is. Even watching the actions of the alcoholic from a distance causes incredible frustration. What's wrong with him? Can't he see what he's doing to fill in the blank? His wife, his kids, his job? Can't he see what he's doing to everything? It's understandable to want to just completely cut the guy loose and wait for him to hit rock bottom before anyone gets involved in that nightmare again. What makes it even harder is knowing there's a huge chance he'll fall off the wagon and the mad merry-go-round will start turning once again. Like I said, denial is one tough son of a bitch. And alcoholics and other drug addicts have by no means cornered the market. They just get all the bad press. I, you might say, graduated from the home just in time to witness the run-up to Desert Storm. On July 25, 1990, April Glasvey, the U.S. ambassador to Iran, met with Saddam Hussein, or to Iraq, met with Saddam Hussein and told him, "We have no opinion on your Arab-Arab conflicts, such as your dispute with Kuwait. Secretary Baker has directed me to emphasize the instruction first given to Iraq in the 1960s that the Kuwait issue is not associated with America." I guess Poppy changed his mind about that. He started comparing Hussein to Hitler. "We had the phony reports of Saddam's tanks on the Saudi border and Iraqi monsters threw Kuwaiti babies out of incubators. All lies, but at least the war was over quickly. Only tens of thousands of Iraqis were killed." It was easy for denial to smooth out the dissonances of war for most Americans. As the head of the treatment center told me right before the war, "When some countries get uppity, the United States has to get downity." He was completely out of his goddamn mind at the time, and he was in charge of teaching all the patients at the home about the destructive nature of denial. Stolen elections? No problem. Another war crime? Forget about it. Mythical terrorists? Blow up a couple of skyscrapers in the Pentagon? Go shopping. A Democratic president signs off on fascism? It's not really as bad as all that. 150 to 200 species go extinct on planet Earth every day? I'm sure they'll think of something. None of these things mean anything's really amiss. Do Martians wonder what the hell is wrong with us? Can't we see what we're doing? Yeah, denial's a mean MF-er, all right. Everybody's got it, and there isn't a treatment center big enough for all of us. As Woody Allen said, quote, "More than any time in history, mankind now faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction." Let us pray that we have the wisdom to choose correctly. Regards, Bob. Another Moment with Bob. Brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. You can also find this at tvnewslies.org in the editorial section. More to come, I'm sure. Keep in mind that there is a little, what's the opposite of postscript? Prescript? I guess it would be prescript, but they're both P.S. All right, well, there's a prescript here that says, "The return of Mike Malloy Radio Gumshoe, more later." Oh, damn. I can't wait for that. Boy, would that be fun, huh? Put a little life back into this moribund program. I'm so sick of talking about molesting priests and prophylactics and Rick Santorum, but I repeat myself. Hi. All right, what's next? Oh yeah, the what is this? I've got, you know, my little notes I've got here at the top. Obama to fold again. Okay, well, during the break, I'll take a look and see what the hell this is. I've got it in red, red type, Kathy. Obama to, or red ink, I should say. Obama to fold again. We'll be right back.
Bed angry, let Mike do it for you. It's Mike Malloy.
Me? Angry? This hour has been sponsored by Gray and Lauren. Her message, U.S. Post Office is built before the war, the handsomest buildings in many small towns across America, and often have the only public art in those towns. And in major cities, post offices are palaces of the people. And they provide universal service at a reasonable price. But the U.S. Postal Service plans to close half of them before it liquidates itself. To find out why, visit this website, SaveThePostOffice.com. SaveThePostOffice.com. And thank you for keeping us lit, Mike and Kathy. Signed, Gray and Lauren. Thank you. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. The Obama administration last month came up with rules that require some religious hospitals, colleges, and other institutions to provide free coverage for contraception to their employees under the new health care law. First thought would have been, wow, that's a political winner. It's there if they want it. And Michael Shear, writing in the New York Times blog, says the idea of birth control being covered by insurance companies is popular across the political spectrum, even among Catholics. The new policy will exempt churches themselves and will have no effect on doctors who object to prescribing contraception. And the decision means the president's health care law will help make birth control cheaper for millions of women. Wow. Jay Carney, the White House spokesman, said yesterday, quote, the administration decided, and the president agrees with this decision, that we need to provide these services that have enormous health benefits for American women, and that the exemption that we carved out is appropriate, end quote. But Catholic groups, including some friendly to the White House, are loudly objecting. David Zubik, the Catholic Bishop of Pittsburgh, told the Catholic news agency that the rule is a slap in the face to Catholics. He wrote, this is government by fiat that attacks the rights of everyone, not only Catholics, not only people of all religion. At no other time in memory or history has there been such a government intrusion on freedom, not only with regard to religion, but even across the board with all citizens, end quote. Is that a little hyperbole there, Mr. Bishop, sir? At no time in human history has there ever been anything so intrusive? On religion? Let me think. I know what immediately pops to my mind, Mr. Bishop. The Holocaust. Oh, never mind. These are birth control pills. Oh, my God! Mr. Axelrod noted that there are similar rules in 28 states, and that the intention of this rule is to provide employees of the religiously affiliated institutions with access to, quote, the same package that every other woman in the country has, the same right and access to basic preventive care, end quote. But the Republicans are framing the issue as a war on religious freedom! Rah! It's war! The Muslim in the White House! Rah! So, Mr. Obama may be open to compromising on this rule, the senior strategist said this morning. David Axelrod, who serves as an advisor to Obama's reelection campaign, said on MSNBC's Morning Joe program that the president would, quote, look for a way, end quote, to address the vocal opposition from Catholic groups who say the rule forces them to violate their religious beliefs against contraception. Yes, indeed. We send secret police into their homes. We pry open their mouths with a little piece of metal. We ram the birth control pills down their throats, then we pour in water, then we force their mouths shut and stroke their throats so they have to swallow. Maybe we should rethink that. The Axelrod said, we certainly don't want to abridge anyone's religious freedoms. So we're going to look for a way to move forward that both provides women with the preventive care they need and respects the prerogatives of religious institutions. Mitt Romney frames it this way. He said in at a rally in Colorado the other day, quote, the same administration said that in churches and the institutions they run, such as schools and, let's say, adoption agencies, hospitals, that they have to provide for the employees free of charge contraceptives, morning after pills, in other words, abortive pills and the like at no cost. Abortion, abortion, abortion. Think what this does to people and faiths without sharing those views. This is a violation of conscience. End quote. Now, I watched this morning MSNBC. I was watching Joe and Mika Brzezinski, and it was really painful to watch Mika try to explain to this half-ass sitting next to her, Joe Scarborough, what this provision is all about, until she finally gave up, because after all, it is Morning Joe, not Morning Mika. And plus, Mika Brzezinski plays the part quite well, I might add, of the battered wife. That's what the Morning Joe program is about. It's about the frumpy-ass conservative husband and the almost liberal wife who constantly gets battered verbally by the lump sitting next to her. So this morning, Mika played her role quite well, and Joe played his exceedingly well. It was really something to see. An assault on religion. It's an assault on religion. They're going to come into your homes. And see, this is the part that drives me insane. It's not the state that comes into your home. It's the church that goes into your obstetrician's office. It's the religious crazy bastards who are driving this. And yet they sit back and say, oh, religion is under assault. No. Religion isn't. Religion is the assailant. Stick around if you can handle it. We'll be right back. It is 7 past the hour. Do you want to take a little walk through a sea of hypocrisy here? That's something we don't do very often on this program, right? I think we are all aware that the Syrian government of Assad is involved in war crimes of the worst kind. I think they're the worst. Well, second worst. The worst is to go kill other people. The second worst is to have a regime that starts killing its own people. No, I'm not going to say anything about targeting American citizens by the Obama administration. Not going to say a word about that. No. Talking about the Assad government in Syria. There are estimates as many as 6 to 10,000 people have been butchered by men, women, and children by this regime. The global community, once again, doesn't know how to stop something like this. Now, there was a vote in the United Nations the other day. When was it? Damn it, when was it? Just in the past day or two. And it was a resolution condemning Syria and calling for a peaceful transfer of power. And Russia and China vetoed that resolution. And Bashar al-Assad, the dictator of Syria, apparently has taken that veto or the failure of UN Security Council to stop this as a license to escalate the killing. There are people in Syria begging, you've seen the videos, begging for intervention, begging for other countries to stop what's going on in that country. Yesterday, government forces, according to reports, used tanks and machine guns. They're blasting everything now, a makeshift medical clinic, residential areas in homes, which is a major center of these protests. And according to the New York Times editorial, since Friday, last Friday, an estimated 240 people have been killed in perhaps the bloodiest episode in the 11-month-old uprising. But the Times takes it one step further and says Moscow and Beijing now have the blood of Syria's valiant people on their hands as well. And the reason the Times says that is because both the Russians and the Chinese argued that the resolution, which endorsed an Arab League initiative, would expand the conflict. Now, the Times calls that nonsense, and it just may be. But I have some questions for you. You know, when the United Nations gets its balls in an uproar about Syria, or gets its balls in an uproar about Libya, or gets its balls in an uproar about Morocco, where is the same balls in the uproar syndrome regarding Israel's treatment of the Palestinians? That never happens, does it? I found something interesting here. Stephen Zunes, who's a professor of politics, University of San Francisco, he just wrote a piece called Syrian Repression, the Chinese-Russian Veto, and U.S. Hypocrisy. Let me quote something he said here. First of all, the setup, he writes, as unarmed civilians continue to be slaughtered by the Syrian regime, permanent members of the UN Security Council continue to put their narrow geopolitical agenda ahead of international humanitarian law. Just as France continues to shield Morocco from accountability for its ongoing occupation and repression in Western Sahara, and the United States continues to shield Israel from having to live up to its obligations under international humanitarian law, Russia and China now have used their permanent seats on the UN Security Council to protect the Syrian regime from accountability for its savage repression against its own citizens. And then Zunes points out what a lot of Americans are just simply unaware of. First, he says, since 1970, what's that, 41 years, China has used its veto power 8 times. Russia and the former Soviet Union has used its veto power 13 times. The United States has used its veto power 83 times. Now, let me just repeat that. In 41 years, China has used its veto power 8 times. Russia and the former Soviet Union vetoed 13 times. The United States has used our veto power 83 times, primarily in defense of allies accused of violating international humanitarian law. 42 times. The U.S. vetoes were used to protect Israel from criticism for illegal activities, including suspected war crimes. 42 times. Yet, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton insists that it is the Russians and the Chinese who have, her word, neutered the Security Council in its ability to defend basic human rights. You know, it's astonishing. We've talked about this a lot on this program. I've been talking about this for the past, ever since I've been in radio, damn near 30 years. As long as the United States uses its influence and power in the United Nations to protect Israel from what, by any definition, are war crimes against the Palestinians, crimes against humanity. As long as the United States continues to do that, how in the hell do we claim the moral authority to condemn a murderous son of a bitch like Bashar al-Assad? How do we do that? Is al-Assad a murderous son of a bitch? Of course he is. Is Netanyahu? Of course he is. What's the difference? Is the difference that God didn't tell the Syrians, this is your land? Is that what the difference is? Is the difference that the world didn't burn and gas 6 million Syrians or Muslims or Christians? I mean, what is it? What is it that exempts Israel from the laws and the humanitarian dictates that everyone else is supposed to live by? What is it? And why does the United States constantly veto resolutions designed to hold Israel accountable for its occupation of the, well, occupied territories? Why? Why do we do that over and over? Why is our foreign policy dictated by the needs of Israel where it concerns the Middle East and beyond? Why? Anybody got an answer? And don't send me your goddamn nasty emails about why don't I go live in Gaza and, you know, I'm an anti-Semite and a Jew hater. You know, stick those in your ear, okay? This is a legitimate question. And it's been asked by an awful lot of American Jews, by a lot of Israeli Jews. What the hell is going on? Now, I don't think anybody has an answer, do you? First of all, most Americans don't have a clue. Have no idea. Most Americans went to see the Paul Newman movie, Exodus, and that was it. That was it. Oh, that's it. There's your answer. Anything beyond the movie with Paul Newman, forget about it. My brain is locked down. Israel, right or wrong, Israel forever. No matter what happens to U.S. foreign policy, no matter how many times they murder American service personnel, it doesn't make any difference. Why? What the hell is this?
Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. More than you from me.
your nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
So, 21 past the hour. So the horror that is Syria, thanks to the son of the last dictator, this one, Bashir al-Assad. Bashir, whatever. The wanton slaughter of literally thousands of Syrians by the Syrian government, because the Syrians, apparently, if we want to accept everything at face value, we're tired of living under a dictatorship, especially one like the one in North Korea that has just passed down from father to son with without any democratic process. So the people rose up. Again, if you want to accept the story at face value, the people rose up, and the repression now has been going on for the better part of a year, and it's not going to stop. So a resolution is introduced, a resolution presented by the Arab League to call for a peaceful transfer of power in Syria for Assad to step down and get out of the way. And Russia and China veto it. So the United States goes berserk about this veto. And Hillary Clinton goes so far as to say that they have neutered, Russia and China have neutered the power of the UN Security Council. And then when you look at the fact that over the course of 41 years, China used its veto power 8 times, Russia and the former Soviet Union used its veto power 13 times, and we have used our veto power 83 times. 42 of those were vetoes to protect Israel from criticism for illegal activities, including suspected war crimes. Now, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations the other day, Susan Rice, and Stephen Zunes has this out at StephenZunes.org, Z-U-N-E-S, Stephen, StephenZunes.org. He writes, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, expressed the feelings of many human rights advocates around the world in saying that she was disgusted by the Russian-Chinese veto. And who isn't? I mean, come on. Of course we all are. But as Zunes says, ironically, Susan Rice herself disgusted many human rights advocates around the world last year when she vetoed an otherwise unanimous UN Security Council resolution, which simply reiterated a long-standing principle of international humanitarian law codified in the Fourth Geneva Convention, 4 previous United Nations Security Resolutions, and a landmark World Court decision. That unanimous resolution a year ago was that Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank are illegal and there should be a freeze on further construction. And U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, vetoed that. And now we stand around wringing our hands and talking about the Chinese and the Russians and oh, those dirty non-humanitarian bastards, right? I told you we're going to talk about hypocrisy. Now, by contrast, the call in Saturday's resolution, one that China and Russia vetoed, for an internationally recognized government to effectively hand over power to the opposition, while that might be justifiable in light of what al-Assad is doing to his own people, but it is virtually unprecedented by the UN Security Council. To ask a government to say, okay, step aside. The UN Security Council asked you to step aside and hand over power. So China and Russia vetoed that. And I'm surprised the United States didn't. As Zunes says, while territories under foreign military occupation, like those occupied by Israel, are clearly under the purview of the United Nations, the willingness of the UN to challenge human rights abuses within a country's internationally recognized borders is relatively new. How do you challenge what these bastards are doing? The Syrians. What do you do? One thing you can do is to get the global community to condemn what the Syrian government is doing. But in order to do that, if you have a resolution that wants to condemn the Syrians for what they're doing, and you are the ambassador from the United States, and 42 times over the past 41 years, you have vetoed resolutions condemning the actions of the Israelis or demanding accountability of the government of Israel where it concerns the occupation of the Palestinian territories, how do you have a moral leg to stand on? Quick answer, you don't.
Hi, Truth Seekers. It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. So, while the butchery continues in Syria, and it is horrific what is going on there, the outrage of the American delegation to the United Nations can only be seen as hypocrisy by the rest of the world. It doesn't make any difference whether you see it that way or I see it that way, although I do, perhaps you do. When you have 42 U.S. vetoes in the U.N. Security Council over the past 41 years, vetoes that were designed to protect Israel from any kind of accountability for its illegal activities, including, up to and including, suspected war crimes. But if you put the word Israel and war crimes in the same sentence, oh my God, oh, you don't belong living in the United States. Oh, don't say that. Why? The United States is guilty of war crimes. We all know that. They won't be prosecuted for the obvious reasons, but we know that we live in a country that is whose government is responsible for a series of war crimes stretching back over, 40 years, 50, a century, who knows? But the evidence is there. And Israel is also guilty. So's the Russians. So are the Chinese on an ongoing basis. So are the French. So are the British. But what is it about this game that if you try to hold Israel accountable, or at the very least, get the hell out of the situation, let the United States be free of its chain to Israel, if we are not going to act fairly where it concerns Israeli activities, then why not just get out? We don't get involved in China's foreign policy except occasionally to condemn what they've done in Tibet or some Bhutan or wherever, or how they suppress the Uyghur people of China. But where it concerns Israel, Israel can do no wrong. It doesn't make any difference what they do. And that leaves us incredibly vulnerable. So, since someone, somewhere, somehow, either individually or collectively, a decision was made, one way or the other, that Israel, no matter what Israel does, it will never, never be condemned in the UN with the United States participating. Never. All right, if that's the case, fine, then why don't we go ahead and continue that policy, but at least disengage, stop funding them, stop supporting them, stop adopting this moral two-faced baloney that we present to the rest of the world. Because, like I said, the average American either doesn't give a goddamn or is not aware of the tie between the U.S. and Israel. But the average citizen of the rest of the world is fully aware of it, fully aware of U.S. hypocrisy. That's all. That's all. That's the only reason I brought it up. The hypocrisy, the ongoing hypocrisy of our government. Good God. In the meantime, the people in Syria are being butchered. Do they deserve to be butchered? Do the Palestinians? Do the Jews? The Israeli Jews? I mean, who deserves to be butchered? Who? And the New York Times really comes down hard on China and Russia, with not even a hint of irony in what they're saying in their editorial. The Times says, while the resolution failed, the support at the Security Council was strong. 13 nations, including India and South Africa, which had abstained on an earlier vote in October, 13 nations voted in favor of this resolution. The Times goes on to say it is a sign of Syria's increasing isolation and the repugnance that all responsible governments should feel toward Mr. Assad's murderous ways. Who disagrees with that? We can all agree with that. What is happening in Syria is horrible. What about what's happening in the occupied territories of Israel-Palestine? Is that not horrible? Newt Gingrich tells you they don't even exist. And because of that, a prominent American Jew gives him $10 million to continue his political campaign. What is it? What is it that determines that the United States will always and forever treat the Palestinians as if they are subhuman? What is it? For Christ's sake, would somebody please explain that to me? Because I don't know. I have no idea. You don't have to kick Israel's ass in order to be fair with the Palestinians. But we don't do that. We never have. We apparently never will. It doesn't make any difference who the president of the United States is. Democrat, Republican. It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference the makeup of the House or the Senate. Always and forever, we will condemn the Palestinians to the living hell that they have lived in since 1948. Why is that? I honest to God, I am not asking like a smartass. I don't know why it is. But I do know this, that the hypocrisy that we present to the rest of the world every single time we veto a resolution that condemns the human rights violations of the Israelis against the Palestinians. Every time we veto one of those resolutions, the rest of the world that's involved in all this, they look at us and say, well, you know, okay, you want to play that game? Wait until you're depending on us for a yay vote, and we'll veto. It just never stops. It just never stops. We've gone so far as to withdraw our ambassador now from Damascus. The Times says other countries should do the same. Why have we never withdrawn our ambassador from Israel? What the Israelis have done to the Palestinians, by the definitions we insisted on at Nuremberg, constitutes war crimes. War crimes. I mean, the irony here is so thick, it's a wonder to me that we all don't choke to death on it. As a result of what the Nazis did to the Jews, we held them accountable. We established international law based on those trials. We executed the high command, the ones that didn't commit suicide. We jailed them. we went after not just their military leaders, but their civilian leaders, too. And when it was all said and done, after 2 or 3 years of the Nuremberg trials, we came out with some very clear definitions of what constituted war crimes, the most egregious all the way down to, you know, just plain old war crimes. And then we have the situation with Israel. We have the situation now. Where conclusion after conclusion that was established at Nuremberg are violated not just by Israel. This is not a singular condemnation. Also by the United States. This is the part that drives me crazy. The hypocrisy. The hypocrisy. How do we tell the rest of the world that we are some sort of moral leader, if not arbiter, and we invade countries like Iraq and slaughter hundreds of thousands of people? Slaughter them! And we continuously back Israel while it continues to occupy and repress the Palestinians. And then we have the audacity to sit in the Security Council and condemn Russia and China because they don't go along with our condemnation of a government that should be condemned. Syria's. It's the hypocrisy. It's the unbelievable, sickening, choking hypocrisy. And that's my question, Truth Seeker. If we really want to find some sort of resolution to some of these issues, then why don't we adopt a stance that, first of all, prohibits the United States from ever invading another country unless we are directly attacked without provocation, A. B, start to apply principles of fairness and justice where it concerns the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Why don't we do that? I've never got an answer. Not from anybody. I've asked prominent Palestinians. I've asked prominent Israelis. I've asked Jews and Muslims. I have asked Christians. Why? No answer. No answer. Oh, I get political mouthfuls of garbage, but no answer. No answer. For some reason, the United States has determined for the past more than half a century that the Palestinian people are subhuman. And no matter what happens to them, no matter what happens to them, we are not going to come to their defense. Before the hour. So I guess the purpose of that 45-minute long rant is based in the idea, for me anyway, that how much more moral authority the United States would have had after World War II when we were seen as, well, first of all, literally the last standing superpower. Of course, it didn't take long for the Soviet Union to challenge that status. But supposing the United States, right around the end of World War II, would have used its moral authority to insist that certain things were not going to happen. For example, the manner in which the establishment of the State of Israel occurred, the manner in which the government of Iran was overthrown by the US CIA, the way the government of Guatemala was overthrown, The way the United States decided to intervene in the Indochinese War after France had its ass kicked and come down on the side of a corrupt regime in so-called South Vietnam. I mean, just on and on and on. The slaughter of thousands of people in the Philippines. And I'm talking about subsequent to World War II. All of these events that occurred where the United States took careful calculation and said, okay, what is going to benefit our expanding the need for natural resources, our need to feed this capitalist monster that has been unleashed on the globe now that World War II is over. As a matter of fact, had a lot to do with World War II. What is our best political move? Not the moral move, not the ethical move, not what is right or wrong, but what is the most expedient in order to satisfy this voracious capitalism that is starting to wind up here in the United States? Supposing we wouldn't have done that. I mean, I don't know what the outcomes would have been, but if the United States that likes to claim this moral superiority, how often, you know, that we are specially endowed by our Creator, that we are the exception to all the squirming, teeming nations on Earth, right? American exceptionalism. And we've done such a good job of selling it over the years. People just flock here. What do they come here for? Come on, be real. You know what they come here for. They come here to make a living. They come here for the money. They don't come here because this is a great ethical paradigm in which to live. They don't come here because the morality of the United States is such that their children are going to grow up, all these immigrants, with this wonderful idea of right and wrong and the clear definition between the two. Hell, we don't even raise our own that way. But I digress. I guess what it is the same problem I have with religion that I have with the political system and the economic system, the filthy hypocrisy, just the ongoing, never-ending hypocrisy, and the violation of the very things that the American way is supposed to be, you know, all those things that were put out there, all the things that the kids learned, I learned in elementary school and high school. Oh, you know, we are this, we are that. We're the leaders. The world turns to us. We're the shining beacon on the hill. Really? Really? Is that really the truth? At what point in your life do you start to question that? Say, wait a second. You know, it seems like every time a powerful figure like Dr. King or Kennedy or either one of the Kennedys or it doesn't make any difference, Malcolm X, all of a sudden people start to challenge that idea. And they are eliminated. Eliminated. You have single bullet theories. You have half-witted Tennessee bumpkins who are assigned the responsibility of the death of King. You have a waiter who is, the world is told, well, he's the one that killed Bobby Kennedy. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's almost enough to make you start believing in shadow governments and a powerful cabal of 8 or 10 people who run the globe and have down through history for millennia. They pass it on the keys to the secret chambers. And hey, my God. So that's what this last hour tonight has been about. It's very difficult to, for me anyway, and I would think for anybody that even has a shred of an ethical sense, to talk about the glories of the United States without working so diligently to try to overcome after pointing out the hypocrisy. I watch the liberals on radio or listen to the ones on radio and watch them on television. And the terrible dark issues of the U.S. are never presented. It's always presented as, why did those dirty Chinese and those rotten Russians veto a righteous resolution condemning Assad and demanding that power be turned over to a different government? And here we sit and continue to destabilize governments, to support terror operations like the Israeli operation against the Palestinians. I mean, the great Reagan and all the terror and butchery that was committed in Central America. The great Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon that were responsible for the terror perpetrated in Southeast Asia. I mean, come on. For Christ's sake, this is not difficult stuff. It really isn't. We're supposed to be a Judeo-Christian nation, right? With the emphasis on the Christian. Where are the precepts of Jesus in U.S. foreign policy? Where have they ever been? Oh, give me a break. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.